Around 25 years ago, when we lived in New Jersey, around 1995, if somebody can't do the math, just kidding, somewhere in that time frame, we were at a park in Long Valley, New Jersey. A little park had a couple of baseball diamonds and other things that most parks have. And there was a group of young boys, about 16 to 18 years old, very athletic. Most or all of them were on the high school baseball team. And a few of our members and their sons in that age group knew some of these boys. And us old fogies, averaging around the age of 30 to 50 or something, were playing on another field. And we'd just gotten there and kind of were warming up a little to have a little fun, have a picnic and all that. And one of the members of our group asked the young boys if they'd like to play a game. So you could see the look on their faces as they thought, we're going to wipe up the field with these old boys. And so they came over there. They were good kids. They were respectful and all that. But you could, it was quite obvious. And it was a lot of fun to watch their expressions change after the first couple of innings. And as I recall, the score ended up being something like 15-3. And they were not the ones who won, by the way. So it was a lot of fun, and everybody enjoyed it. But overconfidence can be a deadly thing. Many very talented, very capable people have fallen on their face, not because of the greater ability of their opponent, but due to their underestimation of their opponent, and because of having a false sense of security, a false sense of invulnerability. Apparently, the Corinthians were suffering from an over-security complex, overconfidence. Paul had dealt with Christian liberty in chapter 8. If you'd like to go ahead and turn to chapter 10, we'll be spending our time there this evening. Paul had dealt with Christian liberty in chapter 8 within a context of idolatry. He went on to stress the necessity of self-denial for Christ in chapter 9. He pointed out that he, an apostle, had to persevere. He, an apostle, had to severely discipline himself in the Christian race. Chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. Familiar text. It says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty, thus I fight not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." Why does he use himself as an example there? How could these people, these Christians in Corinth, think that if the apostle had to discipline himself in such matters, practice self-denial in such a way, that they could possibly be demanded any less from God? Maybe it was because the Corinthians had been blessed so greatly that it seems they were perhaps taking some things lightly. Paul addresses their blessings back in the first chapter, verse 4 through 7, where he says, "I thank my God always concerning you for the grace of God which was given to you by Christ Jesus, that you were enriched in everything by him in all utterance and all knowledge, even as the testimony of Christ was confirmed in you, so that you come short in no gift, eagerly waiting for the revelation of our Lord Jesus Christ." Paul uses Old Testament Israel as another group of people whom God had blessed greatly, but who suffered God's severe displeasure because of their overconfidence. The Corinthians seemed to perhaps have forgotten the idea that baptism and the Lord's Supper were not charms, some kind of amulet that they could hold on to that would keep God's graces on their side. Overconfidence is something that can bring people down quicker than anything. Most people are familiar with the Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 8, pride or overconfidence. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs 29:23 says, a man's pride will bring him low. We're going to look this evening at how Paul tries to warn the Corinthians so they don't fall victim to this deadly way of thinking, this deadly mentality. First of all, he indicates in chapter 10, verses 1 through 5, that privileges are no guarantee of success. Verse 1 says, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers who were under the cloud, that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Israel had been delivered from Egyptian bondage by the very power, the very hand of God. The most powerful nation in the world at that time. What a privilege. Israel was identified with Moses in their Red Sea baptism. Baptized in the cloud, the visible manifestation of God's presence. Baptized in the cloud and in the sea, which was parted by God for them. Israel ate the manna given by the God of all creation. Israel drank water given by God from a rock. Paul did not suggest that an actual rock accompanied the Jews throughout their wilderness journey, though some Jewish rabbis taught this. It was a spiritual rock that supplied what they needed. That rock, he says in the text, was Christ. But all these privileges were marvelous. They were privileges that caused the Jews, however, to boast, to feel confident, to feel very proud of themselves as a nation for centuries to come. These same privileges caused their downfall many times. Due to pride and overconfidence, these same privileges and blessings did not prevent the Jews from falling into sin. And so there's a parallel message for us. And that is that just as Israel was delivered from the bondage of Egypt by the power of God, the Christian has been delivered from the bondage of sin by the power of God. Just as Israel was identified with Moses in their baptism in the cloud and in the sea, Christians are identified with Christ in their baptism into his body. Just as Israel ate the manna and drank the water given by God in sustaining their physical lives, Christians eat and drink the body and blood of Christ in the Lord's Supper, which is part of sustaining their spiritual lives. Paul's point seems obvious when he stresses the word all in verses 1 through 4. We read those and you probably were made aware of that. I didn't overly stress them, but he says again, I do not want you to be aware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual drink, and all drank the same spiritual drink. I'll try that again. Verse 3, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. But then in verse 5, he says, but with most of them, with the majority, God was not well pleased. That's kind of an understatement if there ever was one. Estimations of million and a half, 2 million, I'm not sure, but let's play with the number million there. two, Joshua and Caleb, out of a million, God was pleased with the majority, 99.99999%, God was not well pleased. Paul's pointing out that all of them experienced these wonderful blessings, but even with these wonderful privileges, even with these wonderful blessings, most of them fell away. Just as there are dangers to immaturity, there are also dangers to maturity. One of them is the danger of overconfidence. For one to think that just because he was, as we say, raised in the church, or just because he knows his Bible well, or just because he's taught Bible classes for 15 to 20 years, or just because he has preached for 15 or 20 years, or just because he went to the right college, or goes to services 2 to 3 times a week, or doesn't do numerous bad things, this person may begin to think that he is immune to spiritual stagnation and failure. Privileges are no guarantee of successes. Also, we see that good beginnings do not guarantee good endings. Reading verses 6 through 12, Paul says, "Now these things became our example to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Do not become idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor murmur as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Some years ago, this would have been also back when I was in New Jersey for a time frame there, a couple of decades ago would be more accurate, heard about a young man at Florida College whom all teachers, or at least many of the people there, thought was going to be one of the finest preachers that had come along in a long time. So many people had very high hopes for this individual. A few years later, he was a high priest in a satanic cult. Good beginnings do not guarantee good endings. How much more proof do we need of that than Adam and Eve? Would we not say they had a good beginning? Pretty good beginning. The garden, all things supplied, God's presence. But their ending, at least as we read, was not as rosy. What about King Saul? Started out as a king chosen by God, the first king of Israel, chosen by God. What a blessing, what a privilege, what a beginning. But Samuel points out the change that took place in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 17 through 19. He said, "Samuel said to him, 'When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? Did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, "Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down to the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?'" And then moments later he tells him that God has taken the kingdom from you. Good beginnings do not guarantee good endings. The Jews experienced God's miracles, great beginning, as they came out from the nation of Egypt, as they were fed miraculously by him. and yet they failed time and time again when they were tested in the wilderness and ultimately failed, as we just read. And with most of them, verse 5, God was not pleased and their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. But the Corinthians might have been saying, what does this have to do with us? Paul's saying it has everything to do with you. The Israelites committed idolatry. Paul warns the Corinthians of this very same thing several chapters, as well as in the section we've just read. Israelites committed sexual immorality, referred to here in the text. Same way with the Corinthians, mentioned in chapter 5, verse 1, chapter 6, verses 9, 10, and 18. Israelites were guilty of murmuring against God. I can anticipate, perhaps Paul anticipated, the murmuring of some of these people who were going to have to give up some of their liberties, as he dealt with in chapter 8, chapter 9. His message is, just because you were blessed with such wonderful beginnings, like Israel was, don't think that you, like Israel, cannot also fall. Verse 5, most of them God was not well pleased. Verse 12, therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Good beginnings do not guarantee good endings. Sounds kind of bleak so far. Then we come to verse 13. God can enable us to overcome temptation if we make use of his path for escape. Verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Most of us coming to the Lord, perhaps many of us trying to live for the Lord, want to go on doing what we want to do. Keep the same friends, read the same books, watch the same movies, frequent the same places. Yet we want to be delivered from the sin which those people, places, and things cause us to participate in. Notice Paul's statement in this verse. God will also make the way of escape. Remember David's fall with Bathsheba? Remember Joseph's struggle with the same temptation with Potiphar's wife? What was the difference? Joseph used God's way of escape. David did not. Joseph fled from the sin. David ran toward, or fled toward, if you will, or had the sin brought to him, but to keep the analogy running, he ran toward the sin. It's interesting that twice in this letter, Paul tells the Corinthians to flee certain sins. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18 says, flee sexual immorality. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 14 in our text, just the next verse after verse 13, obviously. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. God can help us overcome temptation if we make use of his path for escape. In verse 13, again, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. The Greek word there is a word for way of escape. That phrase is a compound word. It means a way out of a defile. Defile being used as a noun there, which is a mountain pass. And it suggests an army trapped in the mountains slipping out through a narrow pass. And so God will provide a narrow pass for you to escape through. Just as Peter was overconfident in his commitment to the Lord, yet he failed miserably and denied Christ three times, we can be guilty of being just as overconfident and of falling just as badly. But also, just as Peter went out and wept bitterly and was restored, if we humble ourselves when we fail, we can be restored too. We need to learn the powerful lesson of overconfidence. To the overconfident, Paul says in verse 12, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. But to the underconfident, he says in the next verse, no temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Let us not think that just because we've been a Christian for a long time, there can be many other reasons that we can be overconfident and feel that we are just almost incapable of falling into some egregious sin. Let us be wary of that, but let us also take hope in the confidence that's promised to us in the Scriptures. That God is there, He is there for us, He is there with us. Let's stand together and sing the song we selected.